The grey days crept by with continual heavy rain, and the gale working up a sea that made the Worcester pitch and roll at her moorings to such a degree that most of the black coats deserted the wardroom table, and even ship visiting came to a stop. But on the afternoon of Tuesday, the wind backed into the east, just far enough to allow the Worcester to warp out into the sound and shape a course, every staysail set, topsail yards braced up, cracking taut, all seamen on deck, all landsmen ordered below for Penley Point. Then, shaving the headland so close that the quarterdeck held its collective breath, while Stephen privately crossed himself, she edged away, brought the breeze onto her larboard quarter, dropped her courses, and ran clear out into the channel under all plain sail, the first to leave Plymouth apart from a revenue cutter since the blow began. "The skipper's in a hell-fire hurry," observed Summers to Mowat, as Jack cast a look at Rame Head, looming through the rain on the starboard beam, and stepped purposefully below.
"Wait until you see him at quarters," said Mowat. "There'll be an exercise tonight, and you'll have to rattle your guns out pretty brisk to please him."
"Well, as for that," said Summers, "I'm not at all afraid. I know how to make my men skip, I believe."
Jack was indeed in a hell-fire hurry. Not only did he always long to be at sea, and even more so this time than usual, out of lawyer's reach and before he could be saddled with a convoy, but he knew very well that the Brest squadron had been blown off their station, and that he had a fair chance of snapping up any French privateer that might take advantage of their absence and of the easterly wind to run into the ocean, there to cruise for British merchantmen. Privateers, or even, with great luck, a frigate. For although any French frigate he'd ever seen would surely have the legs of the Worcester, which added sloth to unresponsiveness and lack of beauty, his ship could throw a broadside of 721 pounds.